Well, welcome. Thanks for being here. I'm Ben Jedlovec, the president of Baseball Info Solutions, and I'm here to talk to you today about trajectory-based defense and pitching statistics, or hitting and pitching statistics, sorry, and defense independence and the, kind of some of the things we can do with that. I had the good fortune 2 years ago to present some information here at this conference on batted ball profiles of hitters and pitchers, looking at the hitters and pitchers with different types of batted balls, whether they be high fly balls or a lot of line drives, shallow line drives, or a lot of hard ground balls, soft ground balls, et cetera. And this year, I'm building off of a lot of that. And so those of you who were here for the presentation 2 years ago, you're going to get a quick refresher. Those of you who weren't here 2 years ago, you're going to get a quick introduction recap of that. And then we're going to dig in and build off of that a few more steps down the road. So. All right. First of all, I'm working with Baseball Info Solutions timer data, and this includes batted ball timer information for fly balls, which is the hang time, as well as ground balls in line. For ground balls, we're tracking the time of the ball through the infield, so we can get its velocity, its average velocity traveling through the infield that way. We're combining that with hit locations and our batted ball data to get essentially the trajectory, the information about the trajectory of the batted ball. We've used this in our defensive analytics in the fielding Bible. We've built our defensive system around this information to get an approximation of the difficulty of every batted ball. So we can say that this batted ball was fielded by the league on average about 57% of the time for an out and 43% of the time for a hit or an error. So we use that on the defensive side, but what we're talking about today is turning that around and using that for hitters and for pitchers, and what can we learn about hitters and pitchers from this same type of approach. And what this really gets into is defense independence statistics, defense independent batting statistics, defense independent pitching statistics. And I use defense independence, a quick note, just kind of a sidebar on this, I'm going to continue using these terms, but it's more than just defense independence. It's, it gets into parks, it gets into other factors that we might, just attribute to luck because they tend to even out over the long run, or maybe they don't. So we use this term defense independence a little bit lightly in this case because it's more than just defense independence that we're going for here. And I haven't come up with a creative acronym other than to borrow defense independent pitching statistics from Voros. Voros is probably somewhere here. Voros is over here. Who came up with the idea for defense independent pitching statistics. And what we're really breaking this into is taking that a couple steps further and determining exactly how much control do pitchers and batters have over those balls in play and how much is attributable to the defense or other factors. And I know, some of you guys have had a lot of success creating some creative and catchy acronyms in the past, so maybe one of you guys can help me come up with a better name for this. But I'm going to first take you through ground balls. And what I've got here, excuse me, as I turn here, I'll probably lose you on the microphone. So over in the top left corner, well, let me walk you through the graph first. We have batted ball velocity on the x-axis, and we have out ratio, the percentage of the time that the play goes for an out, on the y-axis. And what this graph is showing us here is we got the dribblers, the slow ground balls, here on the left side, the top left side, that they get out in front of the catcher, but in front of the pitcher as well, and they have to, pounce on it, try to get the ball to first base in time. Those aren't always fielded for outs, about 70% of the time, based off of this graph. If the batter hits it a little bit harder, we have a routine ground ball. Infielder sucks it up, gets it over to first base. Those are converted for outs 90% of the time or more. And then the harder that the batter hits the ball, the more likely it is to get through the infield and go for a hit. So this is intuitive, common sense. We're just creating a model here to kind of use this information to our benefit. Of course, one important variable on ground balls is speed. So as you would expect, the faster guys tend to beat out ground balls more often than the slower guys. All right, so here's, you can see the yellow is the slow guys on ground balls. We have the same curve for both the slow guys and the fast guys. And the slow guys were converted, their ground balls were converted for outs about 15-20% more often, particularly on the left side of this graph where the ball in play is hit a little bit slower and their speed comes more into play than on the right side of this graph where the question is more, did it get through the infield or not? So this is an important variable that when we're looking at individual hitters, we're certainly going to need to adjust for, right? So we'll come back to that later. fly balls and line drives here. We created this graph. We kind of call it tornado plots because you can kind of see like a shape of a tornado here. I grew up in Alabama, and they have a lot of tornadoes down there, so I kind of like that. But on the x-axis, we have distance from home plate. On the y-axis, we have hang time. I'll use the pointer over here for you guys so I don't neglect you entirely, too. But so if we use the top left of the graph here is the pop-ups region. And those are the ones that don't go very far, and they are hit high into the air, okay? The background image here, the red and the yellow, indicates whether the likelihood that a given ball is going to be converted for an out. So the yellow are the regions where the balls are likely outs. The red are the region where they're likely hits. And then you've got some gradient in there where there's an orange region where it's somewhere in the middle. So let me walk you through the rest of this graph. So we've got the pop-ups in the top left corner. Down here, we've got line drives at about 200 feet in a couple of seconds, just a couple of seconds in the air. The higher they hang in the air, the more likely they're going to be outs. You get bloop singles in here, and then they turn into those kind of in-between infield and outfield pop-ups that one of the three or four fielders tracks down if they hang in the air long enough. Over here, we got the routine fly balls, a nice little bulge in our yellow here for where outfielders traditionally get to these fly balls, about 300 feet and a few seconds, several seconds in the air. And then lastly, as we get closer to the right edge of the graph, we get back into the extra base hit territory, and then ultimately the balls are going over the fence. The further you hit the ball, the more likely it is to be a hit because it's going to go over the fence. So all of this, again, is intuitive. This is just a way of visually displaying kind of the model we're going to be working with. So if you imagine every fly ball, just plot it on here and kind of in your mind try to approximate how often you think that ball would go for a hit. So let's say you have a 250-foot fly ball that hangs in the air for like 3 seconds. That could be one of those no man's land that that could fall in. It might not be in the air long enough for an outfielder or infielder to quite get underneath it. It might be 50-50 whether it goes for a hit or an out. If he hits it a little bit deeper, it might be something that they could go for a double or a single. So one of the points here is actually, let me skip ahead two slides because I'm going to come back to this, but we're going to get away from just looking at the results of the balls in play. We're going to see the whole scale of probabilities of possible outcomes for each ball in play. So instead of thinking of a play as a fly out or a single, we're going to think of it as, it was 50% chance of being an out, maybe 30% chance of being a single, and a 20% chance of being a double. So we're going to break down this whole range, and we're going to consider batted balls that way, as opposed to just looking at the outcomes. So the interesting thing about this is its predictive power in small samples, and that's where this is going to be really interesting. So we use a technique called a split-half correlation, and what that means is we take a sample of data, take a season of data of balls in play for a given hitter. And we'll break it randomly into two pieces, okay, two groups. And we'll look at the characteristics of one group and compare them to the characteristics of the other group. And, for what characteristics could we look at? We could look at ground ball velocity, for instance. We'll see how the ground ball velocity in one group compares to the ground ball velocity of the other group. And we do this for all hitters, and we can run a correlation there. And we'll see how consistent they are. And usually, the larger your sample, the stronger this correlation is going to be. You have more data, and these characteristics are going to be more consistent. But we can ask ourselves, at what point, what sample size do we reach like a certain threshold of stability, we'll call it, stability or consistency between these two groups, between these split halves. So one threshold we could use is a stability point of 0.50, so a correlation of 0.50. The higher the correlation, the stronger the two groups are related, or the two pieces of information are related. So if we use this benchmark, and we can ask ourselves, how big do we have to make these samples to get something meaningful, something stable? So for ground ball velocities, that's about 95 ground balls. That's close to a full season of ground balls, usually for a full-time regular major league player. But that's a quicker batting average, for instance, for reference, does not hit this point of stability in a season. It takes multiple years to get to that same level of stability. Fly ball distance stabilizes even faster, 55 fly balls, which is well under a full season. That's a month or two of a season. And if you look at the fly ball distance, essentially what this is saying is hitters who tend to hit fly balls deep continue to tend to hit deep fly balls. Not really a surprise, but we're measuring this objectively. We're measuring how consistent this is. And lastly, look at hang time for hitters. hang time stabilizes very quickly. So the guys who hit high fly balls tend to continue to hit high fly balls. And you only need 35 balls in the air to reach that that level of stability, the same level of stability. So this is interesting because it stabilizes a lot faster than the results-based analysis, looking at the outcomes of the batted balls. Quick glance at pitchers, and we're going to circle back to hitters for a couple more minutes. We can run these similar split-half correlations for pitchers, and there is a correlation there. It's not nearly as strong as it is for hitters. You can look at ground ball velocity, fly ball distance, and hang time, and one of the three gets there over the course of a season at 100 fly balls. The others have a correlation. It's not zero, so we shouldn't fully assume that these balls are completely random, but there is a little bit there. But it's not as much. So we'll circle back to that. We talked about results-based. So let me walk you through the model that we're using here. We constructed a model very similarly to how the range and positioning component of defensive run saved, our defensive metric, works. And it looks at batted balls and puts them in similar buckets based on their characteristics and trajectories and approximates what would have happened on average. So independent of that individual event, we can look at what would have happened if that event had happened 100 times over the course of the season. So the factors included in this model are batted ball location, hang time and ground ball velocity for fly balls and ground balls respectively, bat side, so whether it's a right-handed batter or a left-handed batter, important variable, especially infield positioning, but important in the outfield as well. Speed, as we saw a few slides ago, we saw how speed made a huge difference on ground balls, as we would expect. And I haven't talked about this one yet, and this is power. Why do we want to adjust for power? Well, what we found without including isolated power as a variable is we had guys like Juan Pierre who would hit shallow fly ball after shallow fly ball, and these would ordinarily go for singles against an average position defense, but because they were shallow fly balls, because he was Juan Pierre, the outfielders knew he wasn't going to hit it over their head. So he plays in a little bit. Ben Revere is probably the modern example, or the more contemporary example. He hits the fly balls shallower, and so the outfielders cheat in on him and take away a lot of line drives that would have been hits for other guys with outfielders playing a little bit deeper. So we needed to create kind of a proxy for this positioning by using power as a variable. Excuse me. The last thing that I wanted to talk about, and this is actually really important, really interesting variable, and that's park factors. There's a couple aspects of park factors that are important here. One is, let me just walk you through the traditional park factors first. The traditional park factors, you look at how many home runs were hit by a team in their home park and how many home runs did they allow in their home park. Compare that to how many they hit and how many they allowed on the road. You create a multiplier, and you use that multiplier against their batting stats and the home runs they allowed, and you come up with park-adjusted numbers, right? Well, that's reliant on those don't stabilize very quickly. Those take many seasons of data before you get consistent information, and those in large part because they're reliant on the outcomes of batted balls. And there's only so many, maybe 200 home runs hit over the course of the season. Still a relatively small sample. So by looking at the individual batted balls and their trajectories, a fly ball hit, 400 feet to straightaway center field, in some ballparks that's a home run, in some ballparks that's not. And if we look at the individual batted balls, we can come up with more accurate park factors rather than just looking at the overall outcomes regardless of where the ball went. So we can break this down by left field, center field, right field. We can look at the depth of the fly balls, et cetera. And that has a couple of ramifications. One is it makes more accurate park factors, and two, that means that we can adjust our numbers more accurately for the impact of individual ballparks. So we're not using the same park factor for Ben Revere as we are for Ryan Howard, for instance, to stick with the Phillies. And that's an important kind of distinction that we haven't always been able to utilize. The last note on the model here is I'm using 5 years of data from BIS as the baseline, so we've got a pretty good sample underneath this. Excuse me. So let me walk you through just kind of the results of this, some of the correlations that we're finding from this information. And we're using year-to-year correlations. In other words, how consistent is this information from year to year? And we can look at, for instance, batting runs as a baseline for comparison from linear weights, basically. We had a couple of the inventors of linear weights on a panel here yesterday, and I know they're around here somewhere. One of the recognized standards of batting evaluation is to apply a run value for every batted ball outcome. So a home run's worth 1.4 runs, an out's worth, minus 2.5, or 0.25, that's a lot of runs, minus 0.25 runs per out, something in that ballpark. The numbers change a little bit depending on what sample. So my numbers are pretty close to what you might see on FanGraphs, for instance, but they don't 100% match because I'm using slightly different run values and slightly different time period. So using batting runs and linear weights, we get a correlation year to year of about 0.52. Okay, so pretty good, right? Well, if we look at this defense-independent batting statistics that I'm going to walk you through some examples in just a second, the correlation's a lot higher than that, 0.69 from year to year over this five-year period. And in fact, if you use defense-independent batting stats, DIBS, we'll call it, if you use DIBS to predict next year's linear weights, next year's batting runs, it's actually better at predicting next year's batting runs than this year's batting runs were. Okay, so this is an important point that we can kind of utilize going forward to improve our projections, and we'll get into a little bit of that in a minute. And the last point I wanted to make here is just how the correlation of the residuals. In other words, there is a little bit of a correlation of residuals, which means that some hitters have shown some small ability to outperform this model over time. It's a minor thing. It's a pretty low correlation. And in fact, if you look at the 0.18 versus the 0.10 for guys who switch teams, it seems like there's a little bit of the context. Maybe it's still related to their park factors, something related to their team that's probably still sticking with them year to year. But a lot of that is wiped out at this point with this approach. So let me walk you through an example. We have Jonathan Lucroy in 2013. So Jonathan Lucroy had a pretty strong offensive season in 2013, especially for a catcher who is who's also known for excellent defense. In fact, won our Fielding Bible Award this year, and you'll hear Joe Rosales and Scott Spratt are going to talk about Lucroy here later this morning in their presentation on catcher framing and on our strike zone run save system. So be sure to stick around for that. But Lucroy, with a season that, he hit 280, he had 18 home runs, 25 doubles, a pretty strong season, especially for a catcher. That translates to about 10 runs above average. Not average for a catcher, but 10 runs above average overall. Very good season. If we look at his defense-independent batting statistics, his DIBS, however, we find that actually he should have been even better. He should have hit a couple more doubles. He should have had about 11 more hits overall, an extra home run. He should have hit closer to 300 as opposed to 280. And his batting runs were, his defense-independent batting runs suggested that he should have been worth about an extra 11 runs compared to what his outcomes suggested. And 11 runs, may or may not seem like a lot, but 11 runs is worth, more than a run, more than one win, right? So this is a big difference in evaluating a hitter, something we've kind of already taken for granted that we can do it pretty well. Well, if we take out the defense and the parks and some of these other, luck variables, as we might call them, you can make a pretty big difference. And I'm giving you a kind of an outlier here to prove a point. But let's take a look at 2014. Look at what he did last year. It was you guys probably know, he had a fantastic offseason, hit 53 doubles, or regular season, hit 53 doubles, which is remarkable and very hard for anybody to do. But his batting average was much more in line with his defense-independent batting numbers, his DIBS from the previous year. His batting runs were much more in line. In fact, they exceeded what his DIBS were from the previous year by a little bit. So we could have seen this coming, potentially. That's kind of the point we're going for here. And in fact, if you look at his defense-independent batting statistics from 2014, from this past year, pretty consistent with his defense-independent batting statistics, his DIBS, from the previous year. Just his results changed, right? So he's hitting balls hard, he's hitting them long, he's making good contact, good quality of contact. That hasn't actually changed. His results did change, though. I've got two more hitter examples here. So I've got Starlin Castro. I want to look at his 2012 season and then his 2013 season to follow up. Castro, of course, is a shortstop for the Cubs and a productive offensive player, considering that he's a shortstop especially, driven by a high batting average. So this is something that he kind of lives off of. He has a little bit of pop, 14 home runs, 12 triples that year, in fact. Hit 283, which is actually a little bit down from his previous years where he hit over 300, worth about 9 runs above average, average major league hitter. But if we look at his underlying defense independent batting stats, his DIBS, In fact, this actually suggests there's a warning sign. Or this is a warning sign of what's going to come next year. He actually overachieved, according to this method, by about 16 hits. Should have hit closer to 263 and would have been worth about 16 fewer runs, 15, 16 fewer runs based on batting runs if his outcomes had gone a different way. So flash forward to 2013, he had his worst year on record. He hit 245, actually, lower than even the dibs suggested from the previous year. And that was actually a little bit below what his dibs from 2013 would have suggested that he would have done. He did set a career high for doubles that year, 34 doubles is his career best, but his batting average really suffered. So this was something that we could have seen in the underlying data. We could have seen some warning signs because his dibs for that year, for 2012, were lower than any other year that he's had on record. And of course, he fixed it. He got back on track in 2014. Both his actual numbers and his dibs numbers picked back up. So, we should expect him to continue to rebound and hit at that level going forward, unless we start to see an underlying change in his dibs numbers in the future. And I got one more example here for a hitter, looking at David Ortiz over the last few years. David Ortiz's numbers over the last few years, his dibs and his actuals every year are pretty closely in sync. So, 26 runs in 2010, about 36, 38, depending on which metric you're looking at, in 2011, same thing, 2012, 2013. Very valuable hitter, incredible hitter, Hall of Fame hitter when he does retire, when he does hang him up, or at least 5 years after that, right? But what's interesting is you look at his 2014. His defense independent batting statistics suggest that he was the same hitter. He was still hitting the ball hard, hitting it far. In fact, it suggested that it was one of his more valuable seasons at 42, 43 runs above average, an average hitter. But on the other hand, if you look at his batting average, it was the lowest in this sample here by far. Even though he hit 35 home runs, it suggested that there was still some power that he didn't capitalize on. He didn't take advantage of. Maybe he hit those deep fly balls to the wrong part of the ballpark, or he hit them on the road instead of taking advantage of the pesky pole or the green monster. So this is kind of an interesting thing to watch David Ortiz as he nears the end of his career, whenever that may be. Let's see if he's going to keep hitting at this strong pace. His defense independent numbers suggest that he will, or at least he should have in 2014 been a little bit better than he actually was. So we'll see if that, that can change quickly, of course, if he starts hitting weaker contact. And I think it was back in 2010, actually, he did start the year with a lot weaker contact. And his fly balls were hanging in the air a lot longer, and they weren't going as far. But he rectified that by about May and got right back on track. So it's something to keep an eye on with him as he nears the end of his career, when whether he's going to hang around and continue to be productive for a couple more years, or if he's going to reach the end of the line. So let's flip back to the pitching side for a minute, and let's look at those correlations. As I promised before, pitching runs, linear weights for pitchers. I should have pointed this out before. I'm only looking at balls in play here. I wanted to take out the non-ball in play events because we're not adjusting those. Those are the same. We're only looking at balls in play here. And I didn't want the correlations to be kind of washing out the effect that we're trying to measure here. So I took out all non-ball in play events. If you added them back in, the hitters and the pitcher correlations are going to go back up. Pitching runs, about 0.17 correlation year to year on balls in play. Again, it's there, not huge, not nearly as significant as it is for hitters. His dips correlation, 0.27, was significantly higher than that. His dips year-to-year correlation, not his, but it's the model's correlation year-to-year was a lot better. And in fact, if you use dips to project next year's pitching runs, it actually predicts about as well as this year's pitching runs. So not a significant improvement on the pitching side. And this is kind of an interesting point. That on the pitching side, it's such a small area of consistency or small consistency from year to year. Do we want to give pitchers credit for their balls in play? If they allow a lot of hard contact one year, what this is suggesting is he might not allow that same level of hard contact next year, but he did allow hard contact. It might not be the defense's fault that all these hits went in for line drives or they were hard ground balls through the infield. But what do we, who are we going to penalize then, right? Do we just give the hitters credit for doing a good job? Do we penalize the pitcher for allowing hard contact? I don't think there's a right or wrong answer on this front, and this is kind of off on a little bit of a tangent from where I want to go here, but that's kind of an interesting dilemma that we face. I know Sean Foreman's here, and we talk about pitcher war and how to evaluate this aspect when we try to evaluate pitchers and compare them for Cy Young awards, et cetera. And we're going to do an example like this in a minute. I have one more point that I wanted to make here, though, and that's actually why these correlations are a little bit understated for the DIPS numbers and the DIBS numbers. And that's this, that the pitching runs linear weights, I have not park adjusted those. The DIPS numbers and the DIBS numbers have been park adjusted. If you leave that park adjustment in there, like I did with the linear weights, it actually artificially inflates the correlation because you're leaving the impact of that ballpark in there year after year. So if you stay in a hitter's ballpark, you're going to continue to have good outcomes, provided you can take advantage of that. And if you switch, you know, obviously then it's going to lower the correlation for that particular guy. But the majority of hitters do stay in the same ballpark year after year. So there's an argument to be made that the correlations or the difference between the DIBS and DIPS approach are actually, the difference is much greater than what it's showing here just by this study, because we have park effects in one and not in the other. Okay, so let me show you the example from 2013. The 2014 Cy Young Awards are pretty straightforward. The DIPS winners in the Cy Young Awards are the same as the actual Cy Young Award winners. It's close. You know, Corey Kluber made a run at it with Felix, but I think that's kind of not an interesting example, because I think we all kind of agree about that at this point. But 2013 provides some interesting insights. Excuse me. You can look at, for instance, the fact that Clayton Kershaw had a .252 batting average on balls in play, but his DIPS BABIP suggested that based on his quality of contact, that he deserved to allow about 31% hits, about a .310 BABIP. Based on the balls in play he allowed. Some of that he got spared because he was in Dodger Stadium. Some of that, you know, maybe his defense helped him out a little bit, or other factors. Maybe runners just tripped on their way to first base or whatever the case may be. But he benefited from that. And so if you compare his pitching runs to his DIPS runs, you see a significant drop there. Matt Harvey is kind of it depends on how you want to handle Matt Harvey, because he didn't pitch the full season. But his DIPS runs actually go surge ahead of Kershaw when you take into account the fact that Kershaw's batting average on balls in play was so high, and that the actual batted balls he allowed were pretty hard contact or much actually higher than the league average. You see Chris Sale on there making an interesting case in the AL, pitching in a hitter's ballpark, and he actually should have allowed by this metric, still an even higher batting average on balls in play, but he comes in at the top of the AL leaderboard in this case over Max Scherzer, who had higher strikeout rate and higher win total and ERA, and did win the award, but plays in a little bit bigger ballpark. So interesting conversation starters here, and that's what we love to do, is debate awards, right? So I want to touch lastly here on a couple of small sample benefits of this approach, and things that we can learn, things that we can build off of using this approach or a similar approach. Tom Tango, Mitchell Lichtman, and Andy Dolphin came out with a book a number of years ago, and they looked at things like lefty-righty splits and how long it takes that information to stabilize over larger, and how much of a sample size do you need for a hitter's splits to indicate a true difference from the league average in his splits, his righty-lefty splits, and other things that they studied in the book. So I did this. I print the correlations here, but I did look at the lefty-righty splits correlation from year to year, similar to how we looked at the year-to-year correlations on the other slides, and found that it improved when you look at trajectory-based information. It was significant improvement, especially because we're working with even smaller samples when we're looking at partial season data as opposed to full season data. So these the impact of these trajectory-based and defense-independent statistics is its greatest when we're working with small samples and we're trying to measure small sample changes in performance. Another thing I looked at is first half, second half performance. There was I didn't look at any other years other than that individual season. I correlated first half performance with second half performance, and it was stronger, as you might expect, based on everything that we've learned so far today, with the defense independent statistics than it was with just the results. Looking at the results of the outcomes. So This is something we look at in-season projections, look at daily projections, potentially for fantasy purposes, et cetera. This can have a real impact, really improve our projection systems that way, especially if we're trying to pick up on something, if a hitter changed his approach or has a new swing or has really improved his underlying ability. You know, usually we have to wait for a season of data, and then we're still not even sure if that's a real change in his performance. You know, you think back to Jose Bautista in 2009, 2010, how he just made it such a significant jump in his performance level. Well, kind of the question that I had, I know a lot of people had, is he going to be able to do it again, right? And he did, and it was due to an underlying change in, you know, batted balls. And so we can use this to kind of back up our confidence in these sorts of things. And then, you know, we could start looking at hot and cold streaks again. I know that's a big topic for fantasy folks as well, not to get too far away from some of the real-life applications in Major League Baseball and with organizations. But these are the kinds of things we can kind of take a closer look at. We can take a new look at, not using the outcomes that we've always used to study these things, but using the batted ball trajectories and the batted ball information that's going to be more stable and more indicative of underlying realities. So just to wrap up, we've created a better batting and created better batting and pitching statistics, right? More indicative of their actual ability and their actual performance, independent of some of the context around them, some of the factors around them. And that has implications for projections as well, right? Creating better projection systems, especially based on smaller samples of data. This consistency in small samples reopens some doors for analysis. And finally, you know, park factors is a big thing that, you know, it's always good to have more accurate park factors. It's something that we haven't really been able to do too much of, at least in the public sphere. So I want to quickly acknowledge my daughter who helped with the coding of this. Yeah. Thank you. I'll let her know. She's 7 months old. She was helping me type the coding and, you know, pressing spacebar a lot really drove me crazy. But I want to thank Joe Rosales and Scott Spratt, who helped with a lot of the research and the concepts on this at BIS, my colleagues at BIS, as well as the rest of the Baseball Info Solutions team. I'm fortunate to work with a bunch of great guys, a lot of dedicated individuals who do a lot of great work, and we have it's turned into a lot of success for our company, so we're very excited about all that. Thanks to Sabre for having me here, and thanks to you for your attention. Any questions? Sean. Right. The guys you expect, guys like Miguel Cabrera hit hard ground balls. They don't always have a high batting average on hard ground balls because he doesn't have the speed to take advantage of it. But, you know, the guys that hit, you know, a lot of line drives, a lot of hard Joey Votto makes a lot of hard contact, rarely pops a ball up. That was one of the examples, if you remember, 2 years ago. Never hits a pop-up on that tornado graph. The upper left quadrant was completely barren, and he's one of the few guys who's able to achieve that year in, year out. Those guys really stand out in terms of the quality of their contact, and no huge surprises there. I think there are some the places where we can learn are the guys that we wouldn't expect. You know, the guys who maybe they make 1 year appearance in the major leagues, maybe their performance doesn't stand out based on the results, but based on a small sample, their quality of contact suggests a productive career ahead. Any other questions? Yeah.
Yeah, I was wondering during the season, how do you account for performance changes as a result of non-playing loss injuries?
That's a great question. I don't have an answer. And I swear we didn't arrange this, but BIS is starting to track injury information this year. I'll wrap up. Thank you. We're starting to track injury information this year on in-game injuries, you know, fouls the ball off his foot, and we're going to be able to measure that kind of thing going forward. So that's a great question. And I think I'm getting the sign that I need to cut it off and let the next presenter come up. So thank you for your time and attention.